You are listening to the Passion City Church podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, I grew up in the suburbs of Houston, and it wasn't an entirely monocultural experience. I had a Muslim neighbor from Egypt, had a Hindu neighbor from India on either side of my house, but it was a primarily white experience. It wasn't until high school that I could say, honestly, I had a close black friend that was able to, for the first time, explain to me some of his experience growing up in a primarily white neighborhood. And we would process that together, and I'll never forget the day he took me to the movie theater to see Menace to Society. And we walked in the theater, and I noticed both of us got nervous. And for me, I realized later it was my first time to be in the minority ethnically in a room. I had never experienced that. And then I looked, and he was nervous, I think, because he was the guy who brought the only white guy to the movie. But by the time I got to college, I was a part of Campus Crusade for Christ, and they had opportunities in the summer. You could go to different parts of the world for the summer, and it wasn't just a little mission trip. It was to go integrate into a culture. You'd get a job, work, and many of them were overseas. Primarily, most of my friends went to China. But there was a brand new opportunity to go to the inner city of Denver and live there and have a multicultural experience. And I wanted to go, and I wanted to understand more than I did. So I moved into a pretty rough neighborhood that in the middle of it was a very vibrant church that was ministering to an urban, poor, primarily black neighborhood. And it was eye-opening to me. It was difficult. But I'll never forget, we began to read the writings of John Perkins, and they had a huge impact on my life. So I was thrilled when John Perkins came to speak to us. And I'll never forget, when he spoke, he turned to the prophet Jeremiah. Like many civil rights leaders before him, the prophets gave him the language of the cry for justice and the lament over the lack of it. And I'll never forget hearing him read Jeremiah chapter 8, when he said, "My joy is gone and grief is upon me. My heart is sick within me. Behold, the cry of the daughter of my people from the length and breadth of the land. Is the Lord not in Zion? Is her king not in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their carved images and with their foreign idols? The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. For the wounds of the daughter of my people is my heart wounded. I mourn, and dismay has taken hold of me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of the daughter of my people not been restored? Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughters of my people." The prophet Jeremiah was looking at the injustice in his nation in that day and crying against it, but also feeling deeply. He said, "I wish my head was a fountain of water because I can't stop crying." And he said, "I mourn," which is interesting to me that the word in Hebrew is "I'm black." And he was saying it as a place of mourning, and he said, "I'm black and dismay has come upon me." And then he said, "The hurts of my people, the daughters of my people are my hurt. I'm not separated from the pain of the people among me who are suffering." And then he grabs a metaphor when he's trying to talk about the suffering of his people. And he asks the question, "Is there no balm in Gilead?" Balm was an ointment. Gilead was the region. He said, "Is there any healing for our nation? Is there any physician that can heal us?" And when he talked about the injustice he saw in his nation, he went to a medical metaphor. Is there any healing possible? And he points to the idea and the reality that you can't heal an illness by ignoring it. You can't heal a disease by denying its existence. If you want to heal a wound, you have to expose it. And that's a scary thing to do, because when we get hurt, we want to cover it up. My son fell flat head first on the concrete yesterday, busted his head open, and like any person who's hurt, he wanted to turtle up and hide it from us. And there's risk in exposing a wound, particularly if people around you don't know how to handle it. And his sisters, bless their heart, wanted to help him, and they're poking at it, which is not helpful at all. But it doesn't change the fact that if there's a sickness or a disease, you have to expose it, but you expose it to a physician who can heal it. And Jeremiah asked that question, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there healing for our nation? Is it possible? And then he asks, is there a physician in her? Is there someone who can bind up the wounds of a hemorrhaging nation? And the reality is that he points at is that the magnitude of the solution is commensurate to the magnitude of the problem. The magnitude of the solution has to fit the magnitude of the problem. If you skin a knee, you need a Band-Aid. If you break your leg, you need surgery. If you're dead, you need a miracle. And the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 2 gives us the diagnosis of our problem, and then he presents the remedy. And so I'm hoping we can all go on a journey today, church, to let the scriptures give us perspective. And Paul is going to give us a diagnosis that's worse than I think many of us think, and then a solution that I think provides a pathway forward. But as he diagnoses our problem, the human problem, he backs the lens up there, and he says in verse 1, and you were dead. And he makes it personal as he speaks to the Ephesians that he knew. You were dead. And he uses an interesting word for death there. He uses the word nekros in Greek. It's the word corpse. When Spurgeon taught this text, he went in great detail to describe the horrors of the decomposition of a dead body. And I won't go into all that detail. I'll let your imagination do that. But he said when Paul was trying to describe the spiritual nature of his people, the metaphor his mind grabs is of the morgue. There's death inside of here. And he says we're dead in our trespasses and our sins. Trespass means we've gone places as people we were never meant to go. Sin is we arrived at places we were never meant to be. We were meant to be something better than this, and we're not. We have all fallen way short of the glory of God. And then he says, in which you walked following the course of this world, the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that's now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh. It's fascinating that whenever something conspicuously evil happens in the news, whether it's a bombing of a building or the shooting of a school or the kneeling on a neck of a person for 9 minutes, inevitably, the culture tries to answer the question, why? Why does that happen? And we point to different factors and reasons, and we go to societal reasons. Some people say, well, it's an environment. It's a broken system. There's systemic injustice, and there's maybe a bad environment he was raised in. There were people that said things to you, and it was the system that failed you, a society that corrupted you. But some people don't go to societal causes. They instantly go to spiritual reasons. There's a spiritual darkness here. There's a dark, unseen world behind this. And still others go not to societal or spiritual, they go to personal reasons. They go, no, you made a decision. That was your choice. You did that. We don't have to look for evil anywhere else than inside of that person. And then when people try to quantify where the scriptures land, they typically put them in that second box. Well, the Bible speaks to spiritual things, which is a little bit less hazy, impossible to quantify, and maybe a little less intellectually refined. And so when the nation contemplates the origin of evil, they typically move to more intellectual conversations about nature versus nurture and societal factors or personal ones. But the Bible is more sophisticated than that. As Paul looks at the evil in the world, he says, you were dead, in which you walked following the course of this world. There is a social component to our sickness. There is systemic injustice alive in us, and there are societal factors that infect us. We are more shaped by our culture than we realize, and we absorb our culture around us, good and bad. Thomas Jefferson, who participated in slavery, wrote in his journal, "I tremble for my country when I reflect on the fact that God is just." He said, "I know what I'm a part of is wrong." And yet he continued in the course of this world. There is a social factor that must be named. But then Paul says, and we followed the prince of the power of the air. There is a spiritual component. It's fascinating. Whenever people get really close to real evil, when men were liberating Nazi concentration camps, they didn't ultimately or instantly go to societal factors. They didn't go, man, Hitler must have had a really mean mom. He didn't get enough hugs as a kid. They would instantly go to some spiritual factors of, there's a real darkness here that's hard to quantify and put in a test tube. And people that maybe even don't have faith move to spiritual language when they see real horrible darkness in the world. John Perkins, when he was in Mississippi ministering and was arrested and beaten to near death by, at the time, racist police officers, he said, "I looked at their faces while they were beating me," and he said, "they looked like white demons." And in a weird way, it actually engendered pity in him. He said, "I saw what the evil of racism had done to them." He saw a spiritual force at work in them. But then there is a personal culpability. He says, "among whom we all once lived," and that's good preaching. He's been saying, you, and then he says, "we." It's a problem for all of us. We all indulged the passions of our flesh and of the mind. He said, we indulged in the passions of our flesh. That's talking about impulse. All of us, if we're honest, at some point we were mad and we popped off, whether online or whether to a person, or we took a swing somewhere, or all of us, we had some lust come at us, and in a moment we indulged and lingered. All of us have made a choice in the impulse to follow a passion we later regretted. And then he said, we also followed the desires of the mind, and all of us knew something was wrong and made a cognitive decision to do it anyway. And we are very much sons of our disobedience, following the course of a broken world. And he says, we're by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. Paul calls out evil, and he calls out a divine standard for justice. Justice isn't preference. There is a God who has wrath. There's a place for anger when you see injustice. Imagine if you owned an apartment complex and gave it to someone to manage while you left the country, and you came back and 30% of the children there had been abused and molested, and 99% of the money had been hoarded and not redistributed, and people were discriminated against based on the color of their skin. If that's how someone managed it, your property, you'd be furious. That's not my character reflected on my place. And that's why God feels wrath. He looks at the earth and says, look at the statistics. 30% of young girls, by the time they're 18, have been molested and abused. Look at the history of abuse in our culture. God has indignation every day when he looks at the world. There's a place for wrath. And he says God has a divine standard, and he will judge the world by it. And then he says we've all fallen short of it, all of humanity, like the rest of mankind, and sin manifests in different ways, but we all have the disease. It's interesting. Coronavirus is ravaging us, and I've talked to several friends who had it, and some had a fever and joint pain. Others had shortness of breath and difficulty breathing. Others had no symptoms at all. There was very different manifestations of symptoms, and yet they all had the disease, and sin is like that. It's fascinating. Jesus, in his ministry, he raised 3 people from the dead. That little girl who had died moments before still looked like she was sleeping. still had color in her skin and was probably still warm. He raised from the dead a young man in the middle of the guy's funeral, literally stopped the procession, raised the guy from the dead. The guy was probably already stiff. And the third one he raised was Lazarus, who had been in the grave for days. So when Jesus showed up and said, roll the stone away, Lazarus' sister instinctively responded, no, don't do that. He's gonna already stink. He's got the stench of decomposition already on him. Different manifestations of death, and yet one common factor. They were all dead. And this person was exhibiting more of the symptoms of death than this person, and yet they all had the same disease, all still dead. It wasn't that he's dead and he was mostly dead and she was a little dead. It's they were all dead, not in need of an aspirin, not in need of a Band-Aid, in need of a miracle. And all of us have fallen short. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you've been saved. And he raised us with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. Pastor Louis says this all the time, and I love it because it's worth saying all the time. Jesus came not to make bad people good, but dead people alive. That's what Jesus did. He didn't stand back from our pain. He didn't say that was your problem. He saw the pain of his people and he entered into it. I will take on the shame you're experiencing. I'll take on the injustice you've experienced. I'll take on the inconveniences and devastations that are part of your life. I will make a part of my life. I will not stand distant from you. I will enter in with you. Whether you've been the perpetrator of violence or the victim, I will move towards you. And you see in this moment, he came towards us, not because of something good he saw in us. Although, yes, we're made in the image of God and there's something beautiful about us. The hope today is that God isn't coming to save you because there's something good in you. Because some of you, maybe you look at your life and you say, there's nothing good in me. I'm not worth saving. And God saves us not because of something good he sees in us, but because of something good in him, because of his great love. While we were sinners, Christ died for us. That's the hope today. Restoration is not rooted in our worthiness, but his. And so he moves towards the broken and he says, I'm going to bring you back to life. And I'm not just going to raise you with Christ. I'm going to seat you with Christ. I'm going to put you in the heavenly places with Christ. I'm going to associate you with him so that in the coming ages, I can display the immeasurable riches of his grace and kindness towards us in Christ Jesus. I'm going to take objects of my wrath and make them emblems of my mercy. That's how radical the grace of God is. It bridges the gap between heaven and earth. For by grace, the kindness of God, you have been saved through faith. And this is not your own doing. It's a gift of God. That through faith is where it gets personal. It's the empty hand. He gets personal here. It says it's with him, with him, with him. I'm united with Christ. This has to be personal if it's going to be transformational. If you study Jesus and the gospel like it's a history book, it will not transform you and it will be powerless to transform the pain in our culture. It has to be personal with us. For me, I live right nearby Arlington Cemetery in DC. And I always respected Arlington Cemetery as a place to rest the bodies of servicemen and women who gave their lives for us. And ever since I was in middle school and visited Arlington, I had a respect for it and saw the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, the incredible detail with which soldiers guard that place to display honor to those who died for us. I always had respect for that hill. But now that I live here in DC, I have a different experience because a year ago, this week, I presided over a burial service in Arlington Cemetery for a man who was part of our church, who I knew and our church loved. And I stood there with him and his family and honored him. And so I've never seen Arlington Cemetery the same again. And I got to know a man who guards the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And now every time it rains or snows or is cold or is hot in D.C., I think about the fact that those men, rain or shine, heat or cold, are out there showing honor to the fallen. And I have a different personal connection with that place, and it's intimate for me. And for the Hill of Calvary to be transformational for you and for me, it's got to get personal. We've got to sing like B.B. King, that when I look at the cross, say, I was there when they crucified my Lord. I held the scabbard when the soldier drew his sword. I rolled the dice when they pierced his side. And yet true love conquered that great divide. With shame, I hear my mocking voice crying out among the scoffers. It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. And his death has brought me life, and I know that it is finished. When the gospel becomes personal, I'm with him, I'm with him, I'm with him. His grace comes to me through faith, not through works, but through empty hands. Then it becomes transformational. It changes something in me, because you realize there's no boasting for me. It's not as a result of works. The grace of God generates humility in me. I don't deserve to be forgiven. I don't deserve anything. But he loves me. It's transformational. And when that transformation happens, I realize in verse 10, I'm his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, now ready to do good works that God has prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. He changes me on the inside, and that changes the way I walk on the outside. No longer according to the course of this world. Now I walk in accordance with his works. The radical grace of God changes me on the inside, and it changes how I live on the outside. That I become something new in Jesus. Now here's something interesting, church. Don't turn this off just yet, because many of us, this is where we stop Ephesians chapter 2. We go, that's it, man. I was lost. Now I'm found. Jesus came. Now I'm alive. Let's sing. Put your faith in Jesus. Bring out the band. And normally in our text, we put a big break between verses 10 and verses 11. But Paul's not done speaking. And in verse 11, he says, therefore, remember that at one time, you Gentiles in the flesh, called the uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision, which is made in flesh by hands. He's in the same conversation, and he says, hey, Gentile. It's the word ethne. It's where we get the word ethnic. He says, I want you to remember that at one time you were called uncircumcision by those who were called the uncircumcision. You already preached the gospel. The gospel's enough. And Paul goes, no, as an extension of speaking the gospel, I will now raise up the conversation of ethnicity. And as a function of the gospel, I want you to remember that there was ethnic separation among us, that there was distance because of our culture and the color of our skin. Talking about racial tension and ethnicity is not the product of some political agenda. It is tethered inextricably from the cross of Jesus Christ. Because the cross has a vertical beam that Jesus Christ reconciles by his grace, God and man. And the cross has a horizontal beam The grace of God is that powerful that now it reconciles humanity. And so Paul, while discussing the gospel, raises up the conversation of cultural tension. It's not a separate conversation from the gospel. It is inextricably linked. He says, Jesus has changed us. Yes, Paul, yes. So let's talk about race. Let's talk about that there was one ethnicity that called the other ethnicities this name, Gentile, and didn't just call them that name. They called you the uncircumcision. Some of you go, what does that mean? Well, I won't go into all the details of circumcision and how it works. You can ask your parents if you're a child. But the idea in the Old Testament was it was an outward symbol that was meant to reflect an inward change of a circumcised heart that the people of God, who were the ethnic Jewish people, would have a heart that was tender to God so they could be a kingdom of priests to the ethne, to the nations. And they were meant to take a place of honor as God's chosen people to be a place of distribution of his grace to the nations. And yet he says there was a clientele of people that distorted that message and made the external symbol of circumcision a place for pride. We're special, you're not. By virtue of my ethnicity, God likes me more. That's the idea between calling you the uncircumcision. See, I'm the circumcision. I'm a part of the ethnic group that God truly likes. You're the uncircumcision. Paul surfaces not just an ethnic distance, he surfaces deep-seated ethnic pain in the same conversation. He says, here in the context of the gospel, let's now bring up these issues. You used to say some horrible things to them. When you read the word uncircumcision there, insert a racial slur, because that's what it was. And Paul says there's a place to bring that up, to surface it, remember it. And then he tells the ethne, remember, you were separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenant of promise. They knew to expect a hero who would one day come. You did not know that he was coming, so you had no hope and you were without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. And don't miss this, for he himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility. Why use the metaphor of a wall? Because back in that day in the temple, the Jewish people ethnically could be closer to the inner courts where God was, and there was a big wall. The ethne had to stay out there. And there wasn't just a physical wall. There was this wall of deep-seated prejudice. And Paul says there is a wall, but the gospel of Jesus Christ is so powerful and significant that it not only bridges the gap between heaven and earth, it breaks down the walls of hostility between ethnic groups, and it takes them both and reconciles them together in one body. This gospel is not worth preaching if it doesn't have the power to reconcile the difference between ethnic groups. But here Paul looks at the Jew who had been enslaved in Egypt and enslaved in Babylon and oppressed by Rome. Who was so cautious among the Romans. And it looked to the Romans, who used their superiority and didn't care about the plight of the Jew. And he says, the gospel of Jesus Christ acknowledges our tensions ethnically. It's the human propensity to create us versus them. Yet the gospel is powerful enough to reconcile you both in one body. Jesus Christ's grace is that radical. It makes enemies, not just into friends, but into family. He abolished the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace and reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, killing the hostility. What burden was Jesus bearing on the cross? He was bearing the burden of racist shame. I mean, that's what that sign was about, King of the Jews. Do you remember Pilate made that sign and the Jewish leadership said, no, don't put that sign up there. Say he claimed to be the King of the Jews. And Pilate saw their envy and said, no, I'm going to call him that as a mockery of your people. I'll say, look what Rome gets to do to humiliate the king of this ethnic group. Jesus bore the shame of the Jewish people. But then while he hung on the cross, he was also being mocked by the same Pharisees. The leaders of those people were mocking him because he didn't fit their version of a radical. They wanted Barabbas who would destroy, not a Jesus who would heal. And so he was taking it from both sides. And he took the wrath of God against the sin of humanity. He stood in the middle of all of our pain and he absorbed it all. And he didn't redistribute it, but he prayed for forgiveness while they drove the nails through his arms. God, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. And he prayed for us and he cried out his pain to his Father. Why are you forsaking me? But he didn't curse his God in the process. He entrusted him with his Spirit. And we who were unworthy received an unbelievable gift of grace from an unobligated giver, not because of something beautiful in us, but something beautiful in him. And he made peace with us, killing the hostility. What's the secret to the death of hostility? It's the humility to understand the only way we get into the family of God is through the grace of Jesus. He reconciled us both in one body through that cross. And he preached peace to we who were far, peace to those who were near. And through him, we both have access in one Spirit to the Father. The key to unity is humility. That the ground beneath the cross has been leveled, that the only people worthy to be there are those who fall on their knees and say, I am not worthy to be here. And so I don't hold on to some feeling of superiority over you or you, because it's the admission of my unworthiness that makes me land here on my knees before the cross. And you see that it's the humility that the cross calls for that is the seedbed of unity. The radical grace of God assumes you need it. Grace means to stoop down and bestow, and I need someone to stoop to me. And so if he crossed through all that hostility for me, then I can cross through any barrier of hostility for you. If he bore my suffering for me, then I will bear your suffering with you. Does that make it easy? No. And in the book of Acts, you see in Acts chapter 2, when the Spirit of God lands in people, they begin to speak in tongues and men and women from all different nations come to Christ. It's a revival. The Spirit of God breaks loose. People are getting saved, coming to Jesus. Redemption is happening all through these people from all different nations. And so did putting their faith in Jesus solve all their ethnic tension? No! You see, like verses later, not even in a different ethnicity within the Jewish people, the Hebrew Jewish people denied bread to the Greekish human Jewish people, that because you dressed and talked differently, there was tension. And the church had to say, no, wait a second. Everybody deserves bread, guys. And then as more people came in from different ethnicities, you see the Apostle Peter, who would preach the gospel at the drop of a hat. I mean, there was a guy that was poor that asked Peter for money, and Peter instantly says, money I do not have, but what I have I give to you. Believe, be healed, and preaches the gospel. Didn't even ask for it. But then when God told him to preach the gospel to someone outside his ethnicity, Peter didn't want to go. And when God told him to go to Cornelius's house, the Gentile house, Peter showed up and said, what do you want me to do? And you see that the arrival of the Spirit in his heart didn't solve all the ethnic tension in their culture. And so I want you to put your faith in Jesus today, but will that fix everything? No, but hear this. It provides the framework for constructive conversation, not destructive. It creates the ability to heal, there is a balm in Gilead because there is a physician in her. And he invites us in a safe place to both be reconciled to himself in one body. He says, I delight to see you be as one. And in this context, I will call you to remember your hurt and give you the opportunity to listen and not speak. And you see in Ephesians chapter 4, as he unpacks this, he says, I urge you, walk in a manner worthy of this calling. And he says, with humility and gentleness and patience, bear with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. God has built us together, different ethnicities, into one building, brick by brick. And now your calling, the good deeds to walk in, is to be eager to maintain that unity, purchased by Jesus, wrought by the Spirit, but it's going to take patience and humility and gentleness. It's going to take time. And I don't have a lot of advice for my black brothers and sisters on how to minister, but I will say I'm grateful for my black friends who have humility and gentleness and patience with me. I think about a conversation I had a couple weeks ago where one of my friends texted me to just tell me how he was feeling after the death of Ahmaud Arbery. And I knew that was a risk for him to share his heart with me. And I was grateful he did. And even more grateful that he was willing to process with me. And he told me stories about things, crazy racist things that had been said to his teenage daughter last month. And some naive part of me just was like, I just wanted to believe that that was mostly over. And I know better than that, but some part of me still thinks someone still wouldn't say that. And yet here it is. And I need to be reminded of your experience because it's not mine. And I could walk away from it, but I don't want to, because when one part of the body suffers, all suffer. And Christ Jesus gave his body to reconcile not just heaven and earth, but God and man and humanity together. The cross has a horizontal beam and a vertical beam, that the grace of God is so radical, it creates unity. And I remember when I first became a part of a church that would do communion, where you walk down front and would grab the bread out of a basket and dip it in the grape juice or wine and eat it. I'd never done it that way, and I thought that version was kind of weird, and we may never do it that way again now with coronavirus. But when I was on staff, I remember standing there once, and I was the guy holding the cup, and as people would come forward, I would tell them, the blood of Christ was shed for you. And we do this, or did it, as a church, and it was so good for me to see my white brothers and sisters come and be able to say to them, the blood of Christ was shed for you, Donna. To see my brothers and sisters come of a variety of ethnicities, the blood of Christ was shed for you, Rosa. The blood of Christ was shed for you, Esther. To see my black brothers and sisters come forward and say, the blood of Christ was shed for you, Morgan, you, Jason, that he came for all of us, that I find renewed day after day a sufficient amount of grace to understand humility is birthed at the foot of the cross because we all need his shed blood, and that humility is the seedbed of our unity. The grace of God is that radical. So I want to thank my black brothers and sisters who are manifesting Ephesians 4 to be humble and gentle and patient, bearing with me in love. And I want to challenge my white brothers and sisters. Our church meets in the Howard Theater in the neighborhood called Shaw, named after Robert Gould Shaw. He was a white man who was called up to be the officer over the first all-black regiment in the Civil War. And as he was able to stand shoulder to shoulder with his African-American soldiers, he watched as they were offered a pay that was a fraction of the pay of white soldiers. And he encouraged them, don't put up with that. Don't suffer that. That's wrong. And when it came time to go out to war, he ran out with them. And he died alongside of them. It was customary in those days for the Union and Confederacy to have a time of ceasefire so that each side could grab their generals or their commanding officers to bury them in their family estates. And the Confederacy denied that honor to Shaw. They said he dared to go out to battle with black men. He can die in a mass grave and be buried alongside of them. When Union forces took over that piece of real estate, his family was contacted and they said, "Would you like us to disinter your son's body and take it to your family estate?" And his dad said, "No, we can imagine no holier place for the bones of our son to lay. There's no holier ground than to stand with our black brothers and sisters and try to understand the suffering they've endured in our country. And say, as a function of the power invested in me by the gospel, I will be eager to maintain the unity of the spirit and the bond of peace. I'm moving towards you. And the grace of God can change us. I believe it. I have hope for that today, and I have hope for you. There is a balm in Gilead. There is a king in her. There is a physician, and his name is Jesus. Would you trust him? I want to invite you to put your faith in him. And I want to invite you to believe we belong to the third way today. We're not choosing sides in a battle. We are a part of a new kingdom in his name, bringing brothers and sisters together for his glory.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcast. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thank you for listening to the Passion City Church podcast.